This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
In 1995, Anne Hastings was a partner in a management consultant firm in Washington, D.C. She earned a PhD from the University of Virginia. She'd been a research fellow at the Brookings Institution and at the Advisory Committee on Intergovernmental Relations. She had a life that was busy and prosperous, but somehow she felt something missing. So one day she went to a Peace Corps recruiter there and had a chat with him about the possibilities. And during the course of the conversation, he brought up the fact that he knew someone who had a position in Haiti. And Anne had read something about Haiti and been in the Caribbean, and that sounded kind of interesting to her, so she asked a little more, and the fellow said, well, there are just three things this person's looking for. He wants someone who'll commit for 3 years. She said, 1 year is my absolute maximum. He said she's looking for a person who's fluent in English, Creole, and French. And she said, I speak a little English, but nothing in the other two. And he said she's looking for someone who has banking experience. And she said, I've never worked for a bank. I'm a businesswoman, but never been in a bank. But at the end of it, he said, you know, I have a feeling about this. You should send your resume anyway. Well, she did. And not too long later, she was on her way, and she was sitting down in Port-au-Prince with a Haitian native who was a Roman Catholic priest, Father Joseph. And he didn't say anything about any of these qualifications. He just said, let's get to work. Well, they talked for a little while, and she recognized this man had more vision than most of the people that she had dealt with who were leaders of businesses in the Washington, D.C. area. He understood exactly what he wanted. He wanted a bank for the poor. He wanted a bank where it wouldn't just be money. They'd be accompanying their clients. There'd be an educational component because he said most of them couldn't read and write. And she was enchanted by the articulation and the power of this man's vision. But then they got to the practicalities, and she said, well, if I would be interested in this, how could we do it? He said, well, we'll raise the money. And she said, you don't have any money. He said, no, I don't have any money. She said, well, how would we raise the money? Well, she said, we'll get a hold of Haitians all around the world, and we'll ask them to come to a conference in Miami. And she said, well, how can I do that? I don't know any Haitians. He said, here's the list. So then she said, well, where are we going to have this conference? And he said, in Miami. She said, where? He said, well, they're Catholic universities there. Call them and ask them if they won't give us the space. Well, Anne was so taken by this that she really was, she was fascinated. And as she got up to leave, however, he said, you understand, of course, I don't have any money to pay you a salary. And in addition to that, I'm afraid I have to say to you, you'll have to raise your own room and board. I don't have any money for expenses either. Well, she got back on the plane to Washington, D.C., and on the plane, she happened to sit next to a woman who was there from the Ministry of Money. Maybe some of you have heard of that organization. They do reverse missions. It's not really about a lot of money, but they take people who are prosperous and expose them to the third world. And this woman listened to her, and Anne was saying, you know, this is the craziest thing that has ever happened to me. You know, I can't believe this. And this woman said, you know, almost everybody really would like to do this thing that is being put out in front of you. I think if you just ask, people will help you. She got back to D.C. She discerned a couple of weeks. She got up in the middle of one night and started writing a letter. She sent the letter the next day to 70 friends and business associates and family, and money started coming in. A short time later, they had the conference in Miami. Amazingly enough, a Catholic university gave them space, and they raised $20,000, and they started a bank. in Haiti. In the year 2000, my wife and I were there. We'd been on several trips to Haiti with our faith community, taking people to introduce them to the third world in the same way the Ministry of Money does, to see what their hearts felt after they had that experience. And when I asked the person where we're going the next day, they said, well, we're going to Francozé. I said, what's that? We've never been there before. They said, it's a bank. I said, this is a church trip. What are we doing going to a bank? Well, I met Ann Hastings. And after that, you know, I just couldn't not try to help. Because once I heard and understood what was going on there, I realized that Anne had the courage I didn't have. She was doing what I just daydreamed about. Because by that time, they had 10 or 12 branches, and they had 10,000 or so borrowers in the year 2000. In the year 2007, we now have 32 branches throughout Haiti. We have 120,000 savers, 50,000 borrowers. In this country where it's very, very difficult. So what I think is, I'm a great admirer of Mother Teresa. She was a wonderful, wonderful person who chose to live in a very difficult place and to help the poor die with dignity. I'm a great admirer of Ann Hastings because she's chosen to live in a very difficult place and she's teaching the poor how to live. How to go, how to have a future. So I'm introducing to you to a lady who believes in miracles, and then she makes them happen, Ann Hastings.
Thank you so much, Gary. I appreciate that introduction. Good evening, everyone. I want to thank the CAP Center for inviting me this evening, and I also want to thank all of those co-sponsors who have made it possible for all of you to be here with me tonight. It really is an honor. I also want to thank Mary and Gary Becker for hosting my visit, and especially all of you for coming. And finally, I want to thank all of the Haitian Timashan, the micro-entrepreneurs who have given me the education I need to be able to talk to you tonight about the issue, the eradication of global poverty. As Gary explained to you, 11 years ago, I left my management consulting business of 15 years to go to the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere to help a Haitian priest whom I had only met once put in place a bank the poor could call their own. It started out to be just 1 year, but that was 11 years ago. It turned into a life-transforming journey for me. Tonight, I'd like to start my remarks by summarizing for you where that journey has taken me, including some of the successes along the way, as well as some of the frustrations. I'll be using some photographs of my own to hopefully make that journey come alive to you, because surely what you're going to see on this screen is not like anything you've seen before in Santa Barbara, California. Then, after that, I'd like to offer a framework for analyzing the question of whether we can eradicate global poverty by commenting on some of the perspectives that have been offered by the experts like Jeffrey Sachs, C.K. Prahlad, William Easterly, the World Bank, and my friend Paul Farmer. I understand that many of you in this room probably know who Dr. Paul Farmer is. There's been a book by Tracy Kidder written about him and his life in Haiti, as well as other countries, where he has struggled for comprehensive health care for the poorest people on the face of the earth. And I understand that in Santa Barbara, California, that book is now the Santa Barbara Read, Mountains Beyond Mountains by Tracy Kidder. Finally, I'd like to close with some very personal thoughts of my own. In 1996, when I arrived in Haiti, which, as you know, is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and yet is located just 1 hour and a half by plane from Miami, Florida, one of the richest cities in the world, this is some of what I saw. I saw women, hardworking women, getting up before dawn every morning and going off to the marketplaces to sell what they had bought in one part of the country to sell in another part of the country. They were both the marketers, but they were the distributors as well. They were bringing the only goods that were going to get to the rural areas of Haiti. And then they would come home, as they are here, at the end of a long day of selling, dead tired, and get ready for the next day. The same markets exist both in the urban areas as well as in the rural areas. They're everywhere in the country. The women are very strong women who struggle hard to put food on their table every day and to be able to send their children to school. These markets are everywhere in the country. What I learned is that when you offer these people convenient, accessible, affordable financial services, by that I mean savings accounts, very small loans, $50 or less, and a means for them to receive transfers from their family members living abroad, some amazing things begin to happen. Their businesses begin to grow. They look like this. They may not look so big to you, but they're growing businesses. Their children start going to school. They put food on their table every day. And then, when you combine those financial services with educational programs, in which those who know how to read and write teach those who do not know how to read and write, even more amazing things begin to happen. And then, when those who have successful businesses teach the others basic business skills, even more amazing things begin to happen. This woman is a woman who took her first business skills class after she learned to read and write with Francoise in Haiti. And you can see her sitting at her place in the market, filling out her transaction record, so that at the end of the day, she could make a calculation as to whether she was really making a profit or not. Many of them are not, but they want to know how to analyze their business so they can begin to grow them. And then, when you combine those financial and educational services with healthcare services, such as those that Dr. Paul Farmer is providing at his medical services that he calls Zami La Santé, which means partners in health, even more amazing things begin to happen. So Dr. Farmer and Francoise put together a partnership, which we call in Creole, Crase Cycle la Misère, that means break the cycle of poverty. And Dr. Farmer is helping us to build branches of Francoise, what you see in the foreground there, right next to his hospitals. And then when you add to those financial services and educational services and healthcare services, home improvement loans, just little loans to cover dirt floors with cement, to replace thatched roofs with tin roofs, and to build latrines, even more amazing things begin to happen. You see on your left there the house that this family used to live in. And when we offered them a loan only to help them purchase the roof, they went out and found the materials to build the whole house. So they built a whole house, borrowing the money just to put on the roof. This family was also pleased, not only that they had a new cement floor, but they also had a new roof. This is the house where Wilna used to live, on the left. She actually lived in that house with all of her children. And this is her new home after 6 Solidarity Group loans and 1 home improvement loan. Amazing things can happen in this world. And then, when you add insurance services, as we hope to do very soon, to the other financial and educational and health services, we hope even more amazing things will happen. En combat la misère means let us fight against misery. And this is what we did in Haiti, because this is what the priest, Father Joseph, said needed to be done to give the poor the tools they would need to build a better life for themselves and their families. And I have seen the impact it is having on people's lives. Children are in school, food is on the table, assets are accumulating, adults are reading and writing for the first time in their lives. And most of all, people have the confidence to face their future, no matter what it may hold. I have seen this happening with my own eyes all over Haiti, and believe me, it is real. And you find this going on all over the world today. What we did in Haiti was happening long before in other countries around the world. These are solidarity groups of women that are meeting in the Philippines, in Bangladesh, and in Haiti. Very different cultures, and yet they're using the same methodology, the same microcredit methodology, to help rebuild their futures. They're doing it with great success. Research has demonstrated that access to microfinance has had a considerable impact on poverty reduction among clients in many countries. In addition to gains in income, participation in microcredit programs is associated with better health outcomes, with social gains for women, and greater school enrollment for the children of borrowers. Also, in a country like Bangladesh, marked by natural disasters and many, many shocks that affect the poor, microfinance is almost halved consumption variability for borrowing households. Not only that, but all over the world, you see businesses like this. This one is in Africa. These are in Bangladesh. Women are doing all kinds of things to create livelihoods for their families. These are in India. This is in the Philippines, where a woman has a bakery. She started with nothing, and she built this bakery, and now she has 8 employees working for her. And not only that, but you also find that businesses are reaching out all over the world with tremendous success to bring innovative products and services to reach poor people all over the world. This is the Grameen Bank's Village Phone Program, where they put cell phones in the hands of market women who are selling in the marketplaces, and now they sell not only rice and beans, but they also sell minutes on their cell phone. And now you can see this. That's Professor Yunus, by the way, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and the managing director of Grameen Bank. And now you can see this same program in Haiti with Funcocell, Activé par Digicel. That means powered by Digicel, the biggest cell phone company in Haiti today. But one day you realize, or I realized, that in fact, many people are being left behind for a whole variety of reasons. Some are simply too sick, too old, or too handicapped to care for themselves or others. But many others are not. They don't enter into our programs because they are afraid, or because they are too isolated, or because they have lost hope. And they look like this. And they live like this. And they go to school in schools like this when they have the chance to go to school. This is a school in the rural countryside of Haiti that has this tin roof that is no longer on the school because one day a strong wind came through and took the whole roof right off of the school. One day, not long after I had begun to realize that we were, in fact, leaving people behind, I received a challenge from a partner, Dr. Paul Farmer again, and he said to me, "Anne, I am so frustrated with taking people who are on the verge of death because of HIV/AIDS or malaria or tuberculosis, and I bring them back to health. And then I have to watch them starve to death because they have no way to make a living in this country." And he said to me on that day, "Anne, I will build you branches of Fonkoze next to every one of my hospitals if you will take these people and do something for them." So I began searching. Up until that point, all I had known was Haiti. I'd never been to another third world country. But then I had the opportunity to travel to many other countries, including the Philippines, Bangladesh, India, Kenya, Uganda, the Dominican Republic, Cuba. And I was overwhelmed to discover the amount of experimentation and innovation around the world in how to combat extreme poverty of the type that is prevalent in Haiti. It was absolutely breathtaking. The programs that are the most successful are those that are consciously coupling programs in enterprise development training, even if that enterprise is raising goats or raising chickens. They're providing programs in social development, healthcare, legal services, financial services. They often involve the transfer of the asset. They actually give the family the starting goats, the vaccines, the feed, maybe the land so they can plant some crops, maybe the chickens. But they transfer the asset so they can start an enterprise, and then using a case management methodology, they accompany those people for a period of 18 months, during which they might receive for part of that time a small cash stipend. And then at the end of the 18-month period, they're ready to enter a regular microfinance program because they have an enterprise, something to start with. One day while I was in Bangladesh, I was invited to meet some of the women who were not making it in microfinance, even microfinance with intensive support. As soon as I walked into this small hut and saw these women, I knew I had found what I was looking for. Women like the women I had been seeing in Haiti, who were living without hope. These two women are from halfway around the world from each other, and yet you can see, or these four women, you can see the look in their eyes are the same. I'm talking about the kind of poverty that prevents people from having hope-filled lives and effective futures. These are people who do not see economic and social success as a possibility in their lives. They see their situations as permanent and perhaps even natural and ordained, something they cannot question. They are consumed by simple day-to-day survival. I was thrilled to find that, at least in Bangladesh, even the poorest of people were being reached by the likes of BRAC and the Grameen Bank. BRAC is a very, very large non-governmental institution in Bangladesh. It used to stand for the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, but now it's known simply by the acronym BRAC. BRAC and the Grameen Bank were making it possible for these people who were not even on the ladder out of poverty to put that first foot on the ladder, to provide them with intensive support at a very realistic cost that I'll get to later. And once on the ladder, They could begin the climb and eventually join the others in a regular microfinance program. Here's how it works in Brock. It's done village by village. We eliminate extreme poverty village by village. We start by going into that village and doing what's called a participatory wealth ranking exercise, where we bring together community members from all over the village and ask them to define for us what poverty is to them, what does it mean to them, and how would they categorize people, how many categories would they put out, usually they put out five, and then we ask them to actually draw a map of their village and tell us who fits into which category. This is the start of mobilizing the community around the problem of extreme poverty and mobilizing them to take action against it. Then trained case managers visit each and every family in the bottom two categories to see if they qualify for this program. Because the most important thing is that you put the right people into the program. If you take someone who can make it in microcredit with a $20 loan, and you put them in a program like this, you've done a disservice to them. If, on the other hand, you take someone who cannot make it with a $20 loan, and in addition to being among the most poor people in the world, they also fail and cannot repay that loan, what can you imagine you have done to that person? That's a huge step backward for them. So the trick is, how do we put the right people into the right program? In Brock, they define it as households with less than 10 decimals of land that make their livelihood as beggars, day laborers, or domestic aid, who have no productive assets. That means they don't own a wheelbarrow, they don't own a chicken, they don't have anything that you could use to make a living with. They have children of school age, but none of those children are in school. They're all working. And there's no adult active male in the household. After they have categorized the people in the village according to the categories and the ones that they think should be in this program for the what they call the ultra poor, supervisors come along behind them, managers from the head office, to review what they've done, the selection that they've made. And then the support starts. First, they give them training in some enterprise, goat raising, chicken raising, give them a little piece of land to grow some vegetables. They have a total of 7 enterprises that they train people for. And then they start the asset transfer. They gave this woman on the left, and notice the total difference in these people's presence now that they have something. The woman on the left is someone who was given a very small plot of land, and now she's growing vegetables. The people on the right were given a cow. This woman I met with, and you can see in her eyes the motivation she has now. She has been in this program for about 9 months when I first met her, and this is what she had been given. This woman is raising chickens. She started off with 8 chickens that somebody gave her, and today she has this chicken raising business. And this woman, to the right of where she's standing, she has a little store where she's selling goods to the people in the community. And next to her is her disabled husband, who she's now able to take care of. After they transfer those initial assets, though, they begin a process of social awareness, education, and confidence building. And they do give them, for a period of about 6 to 8 months, a very, very, very small cash stipend. It might just be 50 cents a day, just so they have enough rice in their stomach that they can get up every morning and take care of their asset rather than eating their asset. And then they go back to the community and put in place a village committee against extreme poverty. This is one of the committees that I visited with. And you can see that it's composed not of politicians or very wealthy people, but it's composed of people who people honor in the society, religious leaders or school teachers or just women. Anybody can be on it, including some of the beneficiaries. And their job is to help those beneficiaries to make sure they don't get tempted to sell their asset too early. They might help to build the latrine that they need in the house or put a roof on the house. So the whole community, again, is mobilized around the problem of getting rid of this kind of poverty. Very gradually, over an 18-month period, the women who up till now cannot work in groups because they have no social confidence whatsoever, and now they are ready to begin working in groups and receiving loans. This is a group that I went to visit, and you can see there is still, compared to the regular solidarity groups, you can see that there's still a lot of hesitancy in their eyes. They are just now getting ready. They've had a savings account from the very beginning, and now they're getting ready to take their first loan. After that visit to Bangladesh, it became my passion to bring practitioners like the woman who runs this program in Bangladesh to Haiti to help us design a strategy that would work as well in Haiti as the success that they're having in Bangladesh. And they came for a week. There were people from Bangladesh, from Bolivia, from the Dominican Republic, from Cameroon in Africa. All practitioners, no consultants, no people from the World Bank, just practitioners. And they went to the rural countryside of Haiti, and they spent several days in the field. They talked to Dr. Farmer's HIV patients. They talked to the TB patients. They visited his hospital. They talked to our clients who were succeeding in microcredit. They went to the marketplaces like this one, and they interviewed the Timashan who were doing well in their businesses. And they talked about the problem in the economy in that village. And then we came back to bring together the people from abroad as well as our partners on the ground in Haiti to hold a 3-day facilitated work session to develop a strategy for Haiti. So now, with a partnership that spans Haiti, Bangladesh, Bolivia, India, Pakistan, we in Haiti are implementing this program adapted to the situation in Haiti. And we have very preliminary, very solid results. We're into or about our 15th of May was our first asset transfer. And this is how it works. The day of asset transfer, there's a big celebration. They come together with the village committee, and they get a photo ID card. The first time they've seen a photo of themselves on a card with their name on it. We give them their goats. They've already built, back where they live, the house that they might put their chickens in. And then you can see in the picture on the right, the little boy and his mother have picked up their chickens, and they're getting ready to walk home a couple hours to put them in that little chicken house that they've built for them. And you can see the hope in their eyes. And this is the village committee we have in Haiti, one of the village committees. And we're measuring the results from the very first day on. We have interns that are going out in the field and weighing the children and measuring the circumference of their head and looking at the malnutrition problems. And they'll come back again in another year and pick up the results to see what kind of gains the children have made. So that brings us to today, where I am now as I stand before you. I'm excited. My journey is not at all over with, far from it. In many ways, it's only just beginning, but we have the beginnings of it. And it's been a long struggle getting there. And now I know we're able to include everyone that needs our services. What I now know in my heart is that we have been able to provide the tools for tens of thousands, with a hope of hundreds of thousands, to escape poverty. And many others around the world, using a wide variety of variations on this theme of microfinance, are reaching millions of people using this same strategy and doing it in a sustainable way. But I also now know what extreme poverty is and how much more intensive the services need to be than I ever dreamed of. Microfinance does not work for everyone. They need to be prepared to get into a microfinance program. So, what does all this mean for the central question, can we eradicate global poverty? In this part of my talk, I'm going to make reference to the four books that I would strongly recommend anyone in the room who cares about eradicating poverty to read. The first is a book by Jeffrey Sachs. Probably many, many of you have already read it or at least know of it. It's called The End of Poverty. Equally well known is the book by C.K. Prahlad, The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, Eradicating Poverty Through Profits. The third book is a book that the World Bank put out called Ending Poverty in South Asia, Ideas That Work. And the fourth book is by William Easterly called The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. Two of these books, the first two, state in no uncertain terms that poverty can be eliminated in our lifetime. Sachs believes within 20 years, and Prahlad said in 2005 that within 15 years we can eliminate poverty. The edited volume doesn't take quite such a clear-cut position. And the Easterly book says, interestingly, that whether we can end poverty or not, it's not going to be foreign aid that does it. The most we can hope that foreign aid can do is to relieve some of the sufferings of the extremely poor. For him, the only thing that matters is to figure out what works best at relieving some of the suffering and do your best to get it out there. They all agree, however, that there are things that are working around the world that allow some people to escape extreme poverty, even the most extreme forms of poverty. So, in trying to build a framework for this discussion, I want to put before you a list of seven questions. First of all, what is it? What is extreme poverty? Secondly, where is it? And thirdly, when we ask the question, can we eradicate extreme poverty, who is the we we're talking about? Fourthly, how in the world would we do it if we wanted to do it? Fifth, under what conditions could we do it? How long would it take, and how much would it cost? I want to take those questions one at a time. First of all, what is it? As defined by the World Bank, extreme poverty is what people getting by on less than a dollar a day per person. That's who they are. This, I put in parentheses, PPP. That stands for purchasing power parity. We don't need to get into the complexity of the term, but basically, it attempts to put the value of a dollar on an equivalent scale in all countries. I would argue that there are many, many people living under a dollar a day who can do it on microfinance alone, so I would like to see us talking tonight about people who are living on less than 50 cents a day. But these are households that cannot meet the basic needs for survival. These are people who are chronically hungry, who do not have access to health care, who lack safe drinking water and sanitation who cannot afford education for their children and perhaps lack rudimentary shelter such as a roof to keep the rain out and basic articles of clothing like shoes. This is the poverty that kills. We know, or at least the World Bank tells us, that today there are about 1.1 billion people living like this around the world. But the good news is that number is down from 1.5 billion in 1981. Where is it? One thing all of those books agree on is that extreme poverty, like we're talking about tonight, exists only in the developing world. It no longer exists in the developed world. It can exist in both rural and urban areas, though rural areas are the most extreme and have the most people living like that. But it's a big, big difference to tackle urban poverty like this, which are two photos from Haiti, and rural poverty like this. They're very different beasts, and they require very different strategies. But a very important point I want to make tonight is that this type of poverty is most prevalent in fragile states. What is a fragile state? A fragile state is a state in which the government cannot or will not deliver core functions to the majority of the people, including and especially the poor. The examples of some of the fragile states that we all are aware of are Angola, Somalia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Haiti. Haiti has the unique reputation of being one of about 11 countries that have been on the World Bank's list of fragile countries for 4 years running. A fragile state is characterized by all of those bullet points I put up there on the slide. But what's most important to understand and makes it the most difficult to deal with the question of how do we get rid of this is that there is effectively no government, but to the extent that there is any government, it is incredibly corrupt. In addition, there is ongoing conflict, violence, civil strife, and that makes things even more difficult. And there's an incredible lack of mechanisms for generating legitimate power and authority. But if you go away tonight with only one fact, please take this fact with you. Only 14% of the world's population lives in a fragile state. And yet, 30% of all the people living under a dollar a day are living in fragile states. And even worse than that, nearly half of all children who die before the age of 5 are born in fragile states. If we cannot eradicate poverty in fragile states, we cannot eradicate extreme poverty. Now let's turn to who is the we when we say, can we eradicate it? Do we mean the international community? I'm talking about the multilaterals like the World Bank or the major donor countries like the United States or the UK or Canada or the European Union. Or are we talking about the government in the developing country? There are countries that where the government has done this, gotten rid of extreme poverty without any foreign aid. Are we talking about the private sector? Are we talking about non-governmental organizations like FONCOSE doing this, either local or international non-governmental organizations? Or are we talking about private citizens, including the celebrities like Bono? Or are we talking about some combination of the above? Prahlad, in his book, The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, poses the question, why can't we mobilize the investment capacity of large firms with the knowledge and commitment of NGOs, like those of us who are working in these countries, and the communities of those countries that need the help, to co-create unique solutions to the problem of poverty. He sees a huge role for the private sector and entrepreneurship in developing an alternate approach to poverty alleviation. He demonstrates through a whole series of real cases how the private sector can develop products and services for the people at the bottom of the economic pyramid, which will both help them to make their way out of poverty and at the same time bring profits to the private sector. In fact, he uses the development of microfinance as a perfect example of how the poor can be provided with financial services, albeit very different financial services than the traditional banks have offered, and use those services to build sustainable businesses of their own. Jeffrey Sachs, on the other hand, says, yes, the villages of Africa can be rescued, but not by themselves. It can only come through the application of much more foreign aid than we currently have. And that foreign aid should be managed by officials in the 6 UN agencies, the UN country teams, the World Bank, the IMF, and a couple of dozen rich country aid agencies. For him, the problem is one that only development economics, albeit a drastically overhauled brand of development economics, can solve. These are big differences between the thesis of Sachs and Prahlad. How would we do it? Is it the foreign aid that's going to make the difference, or is it the private sector that can take this on? Sachs has what he calls the Big Five plan. The Big Five for him are boosting agriculture, improving basic health, investing in education, bringing electrical power where there is none, providing clean water and sanitation. In many ways, there are all kinds of models out there that are working. What is a model that works? Usually we mean a model that has been tremendously successful on a small scale in a particular place. The BRAC model that we're replicating in Haiti is not a unique model. There are other very different models that are having some very exciting results. But are they transferable? That's the question we're testing with the BRAC model. If it works in Bangladesh, will it also work in India? Will it work in Pakistan? Will it even work in Haiti? But still, the problem of scaling up is a particularly thorny one. It's rare that an NGO by themselves can scale up on a national level. BRAC is doing a great job of it. BRAC and Grameen Bank together, along with several other organizations, NGOs, are doing it. But scaling up to reach the entire country is extremely difficult without bringing the government along with you. That means that somewhere along the line, the government has to be able to take over. So where does that leave us if we're talking about a fragile state that doesn't have a government? This is the problem that Paul Farmer and I have had long, long email conversations about. Can we do this without government? We can ask the questions, under what conditions can it be done? And here the question is, does it require good governance, a growing economy? Because Haiti didn't, up until recently, have a growing economy. It had a negative growth economy. Do we need a certain amount of security? Does that mean it can't work where we have internal strife in the country? And what about political will? Does that have to be there for it to be workable? Many people say these are the conditions that are necessary for this to work. But isn't that a cop-out? Can we expect that we're going to find these conditions in every country? No, we can't. I haven't gotten to the point where I can accept that I have to wait for good governance and a growing economy and security and political will. I don't want to accept that. Paul Farmer is someone who has led me down this path and someone I admire tremendously. He started in Haiti. He moved his work to various other countries, and now he's working in Rwanda. Although I haven't had the chance to talk to him in the last couple months about it, in a recent opinion piece on the Forbes website, he comments on the lessons he learned after 25 years in Haiti, but then he concludes with these hard, if obvious, lessons came great success for small projects, but also a haunting doubt. Could quality and comprehensive and complex health services ever be scaled up in some of the poorest countries in the world, the very countries that need such scaling up the most? Then when he went to Rwanda, the same tension arose, but this time it was followed by hope and excitement, according to what he's written. He asked himself, could it be that in this small mountainous nation of over 8 million people, which is the same population as Haiti, we can scale up a rural health model for all Rwandans, over 80% of whom live in rural regions? What was in Rwanda, he asked himself, that had been missing or in short supply in the other countries in which he'd been working? And then he lists them. First, there was good governance, security, and a great deal of what's termed political will. That is, the government wanted these services to be available to all Rwandans. Second, although Rwanda is terribly poor and recovering from a genocide, its economy is growing, not shrinking. In addition, there are many NGO partners that we've discovered with significant resources, which, were they to contribute to this effort in rural regions, could help achieve these goals within the public sector. Here in Rwanda, he writes, I'm wondering, is this the country where a truly comprehensive health model can reach in a reasonable amount of time all of the rural poor of this country? If we can raise the money, which we must, I'm betting on Rwanda. This was very, very hard for me to read. Not because he's given up on Haiti. Paul Farmer will never give up on Haiti. But because I'm reading for the first time his hesitancy that we can't do it without having some condition, some basic conditions in place. We also have to ask ourselves, how long would it take to get rid of global poverty? If we accept the preconditions of economic growth and good governance, it won't really take that long. As I said before, several countries have done it on their own without much assistance because they do have good government, good policies, and a growing economy. My son told me last week, Mom, in some of these countries, if we just wait, it's going to be eliminated in the same way it's been eliminated in the rest of the developed world. But if we don't have those conditions, we're back to the same problem. What do we do with the fragile states? Even if we correct the fragile states that are today fragile, there's going to be more states emerging all the time that are fragile. How much would all of this cost? First, if we accept Prahlad's thesis, it won't cost anything. The private sector can do it with the help of NGOs who have good budgets and the help of the community, and the private sector will actually be able to make a profit on it. For Sachs, it's going to cost a lot, but not too much, because for him, the alternative is a lot worse than not doing it. At Brock, it's costing them today, get this, $300 over an 18-month period to bring a family of six or eight people out of extreme poverty and into a regular microfinance program with no further subsidization. Is a human family worth $300? That is so inexpensive. In Haiti, it looks like it's going to cost us $1,000, not $300. But we're measuring it piece by piece, and we're going to do all that we can to bring that price down. But still, for me, $1,000 for a family of six or eight is a bargain at the price. But can we scale it up? And can we do it in a country that is fragile, like Haiti? So that brings me to my closing thoughts. I want desperately to believe that it can be done. Once I had witnessed the type of suffering that extreme poverty brings to children and to adults, it was clear to me that there can be no justice in this world until we get rid of this horrible plague. And I sincerely believe that we do have the tools to do it. I agree with Prahlad that the private sector has a huge role to play in making it happen, if, as he argues, it's willing to view the people at the bottom of the pyramid as real customers, albeit customers with different needs and wants than those at the top of the pyramid. I also believe that tremendous strides can be made, even in fragile states like Haiti. Foncosé, the microfinance institution that I direct, provides strong evidence of this. And our supporters all around the world believe in us that we can continue to make great strides. But can we put extreme poverty into a museum? We can certainly come a whole lot closer than we are today. And there's good evidence that we can do it in all but the most fragile of states. The problem is that so many of these people live in those fragile states. So we can't stop trying even there. I hope you don't view this as a cop-out, but in the end, I don't think we need to answer the question of whether we can do it or not. The answer is simply that we all, each and every one of us, have a moral and ethical obligation to do our damnedest to try, or at least to get out of the way of those who are. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.